This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Chris Bullock. You're listening to ABC Radio National. And this week on Background Briefing, we're taking you inside one of the country's older foreign policy institutes, the Australian Institute of International Affairs, for a seminar on Australia's role in the South Pacific. The day-long event was held in a book-lined room in New South Wales Parliament House in the middle of July.
Ladies and gentlemen, can we begin proceedings, please? Could people take their seats?
The 50 or so participants, diplomats, scholars, NGO workers and journalists all have an active interest in the Pacific. There were four keynote speakers and a number of others who commented on the main addresses, and you'll be hearing an edited version of the seminar. First to speak was Greg Irwin, who heads the Pacific Islands Forum. This is where the political leaders of the South Pacific meet. Greg Irwin sought to set the scene by placing current economic and social problems in the context of independence in the Pacific, which is still a recent experience for island nations.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to be a part of this meeting. We often express satisfaction or relief that the achievement of independence in the region was peaceful. As a generalisation, that view, though, only really holds good if we're talking only about the years in which independence was actually achieved, not in the period which followed, because in the process, a range of old fissures and fault lines, unresolved issues from the remote and near past, were papered over by new constitutions, new administrations, and in a couple of cases, new lines on maps. And that, in substantial part, is what the prolonged Bougainville crisis, Fiji in 1987 and 2000, the Solomon Islands today, has been at least partly about. The working out, hopefully, the resolution over time of some of these old issues. The region has a very broad range of problems, objectively speaking, to grapple with. Indifferent economic growth, rapidly increasing populations, uncontrolled drift into urban centres, declining health and education indicators, weaknesses of governance. To talk of the region's many vulnerabilities is to do no more than acknowledge the truth. To talk of fragile states is fine, to the extent that it helps us properly understand the region's problems. But context does seem to me to be critically important. And such references surely need to be balanced by recognition that one or two things may actually be going right. I find it difficult to articulate this with any real precision, but negative views about the success of national experiments in the Pacific must surely be balanced by acknowledgement of a pretty fair degree of communal success, for example. This seems to me observable in a range of ways. The strength of family and clan life, in the churches, in the devotion parents lavish on their children's schools, in sport, in the plethora of voluntary organisations. Bearing in mind that a number of the regional states are, in global terms, in any event on something of a hiding to nothing, it can hardly be wondered at that this period may be long and quite untidy. The Melanesian countries, for example, appear to face tasks of a nation-building kind, such as we might observe in a range of other decolonised states. In Polynesia and Micronesia, it might be more a matter of working out and refining the interactions between cultural homelands and significant overseas communities. In every case, I would venture to say, it will be about finding the appropriate accommodation between modern national methods of governance and older priorities and practices.
Greg Irwin, head of the Pacific Islands Forum. The new century has come with some difficult challenges for the forum leaders.
The year 2000 was, in a number of respects, the region's annus horribilis, or as I saw in a local paper a few years ago, the anus horribilis. In the middle of that year, two dramatic sets of events took place In May, the government of Fiji and a number of other citizens were taken hostage in Suva's Parliament House, and shortly afterwards, in what some were tempted to see as something of a copycat event, but which really had a much deeper derivation than that, the government of Solomon Islands, against a background of years of communal strife, was overthrown. The forum leaders sought to respond to all of this. The regional foreign ministers met in Apia in August 2000 to address the situation, the first time this particular mechanism had been employed. They did not, on that occasion, propose immediate forum action. When the leaders came together later in the year in Kiribati, they adopted an instrument which they called the Bikitawa Declaration, so named because that small island was the venue for the leaders' retreat that year. Leaders, and I quote it, while respecting the principle of non-interference in the domestic affairs of another state, recognised, again to quote it, the need in time of crisis or in response to members' requests for assistance for action to be taken on the basis of all members of the forum being part of the Pacific Islands extended family. The forum must, they said, constructively address difficult and sensitive issues, including underlying causes of tension and conflict. Bikitawa is interesting, regionally speaking, in at least two ways. First, it amounted to the first explicit recognition that the internal affairs of a member state might, in certain circumstances, be the legitimate concern of the forum as a whole, that the problems of one might be the problems of all. Secondly, it represented the first attempt in a direct sense to assemble a vehicle for conflict prevention, even though it was clear that the Secretary-General, in particular, has to be pretty careful about arriving at the conclusion that a crisis situation might actually exist. Bikitawa has been invoked twice since 2000, most notably in respect of Solomon Islands, and in July 2003, the Bikitawa Declaration was the enabling mechanism through which the Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands was mounted. This being the world, there has been inevitably, but I think in the end superficially, a good deal of cynicism attending the assistance mission arrangements. It was, some said, simply in an Australian-New Zealand show cloaked in regional rhetoric. Not in the end a fair call, in my view, for two reasons. I think that for the foreseeable future, it is likely to be a fact of regional life that efforts of this kind will need to be underwritten by those regional members with relatively greater access to resources. There seems to me to be little problem in principle with this, provided the action contemplated has genuinely shared regional objectives. In the case of the Solomons intervention, this was, I think, true. The other occasion on which Bikitawa has been invoked was in 2004 by Nauru, in the context of its ongoing financial crisis. The leaders at their meeting in Apia in August 2004 agreed that the forum should do all it could practically do to assist Nauru. In the context of the developing process, I've been trying to describe what seems to me interesting and positive about what the leaders have directed is that it represents the use of the Bikitawa instrument at a conflict prevention stage. There are several features of the Bikitawa Declaration that make it unusual and potentially very useful to this region. Not least of these is its holistic view of the importance of upholding democratic processes, its commitment to good governance, and its recognition of Indigenous rights and cultural values. This balanced view can, I believe, help the region deal with various of the security threats it faces.
As well as the Bikitawa Declaration, Greg Irwin spoke about another initiative adopted by the Pacific leaders at the end of last year. He says it represents new thinking, even if the name, the Pacific Plan, is somewhat anachronistic.
It's not a very good name in many ways. Too Stalinist, too definite, implying too much comprehensiveness. But again, it's a new response, a quite coherent, far-sighted attempt to meet some of our common challenges in practical terms. Its initiatives are organised in terms of four goals: economic growth, sustainable development, good governance and security, and they're scheduled for accomplishment over a number of years and are of basically two categories. The first category would seek to strengthen activities at a national level by use of a regionally based resource, a better version of what we do now, in fact. The second category would involve the actual provision on a regional basis of a service previously provided country by country. A regional statistics service or a regional audit office might be cases in point. To the extent we take this path, we shall be moving towards a closer regional integration. It's achieved a good deal of support among the region's development partners, and expectations of it within the region are at this stage quite considerable. It gives the region, I think, a shared script which goes some way to expressing shared regional objectives, and that's quite important. It is another of those positive elements in our regional situation which should be built upon. I think it is critically important for the future of the region as a whole that the full relationship between the island countries on the one side and the two proximate metropoles on the other, that we seek to express that relationship in a rather fuller sense. We've never really done this. The fact that we are all forum members goes perhaps closest to doing so. And we now have, I think, an opportunity to move forward beyond even the broader economic relationship of which the Pacific Plan speaks. We might conceive of such an expression, a comprehensive expression of the relationship, as containing not only, for example, a trade arrangement for goods and services, but perhaps a statement of development assistance objectives, a statement of joint security-related goals, and some understandings as regards the future movement of people. And speaking for a moment as an Australian rather than as a regional citizen, and perhaps emboldened by the fact that we are meeting not far from the place where Australia, and with it its Pacific ambitions, began, it may resolve some things, some matters for us as well. It may serve to still, in Windeyer's 19th century phrase, this whispering in our hearts. My very best wishes for the conference.
Greg Irwin, head of the Pacific Islands Forum and the first speaker at a recent seminar on Australia's role in the South Pacific, recorded by Background Briefing.
Dr. Jimmy, over to you.
Some brief comments followed by Dr. Jimmy Rogers, an experienced and respected public servant from the Solomon Islands, who is now Director General of the South Pacific Community. Jimmy Rogers referred to an important debate for the region in light of the intervention in the Solomon Islands.
Countries at the moment, and that is the question between full national sovereignty vis-à-vis shared sovereignty. And I think that's one of the common debates that governments either use to advantage or hide behind. And I think it sometimes muddy the waters of how best you move forward. It established the vulnerability of the countries is not just because of their size, not just because of their geographical isolation, but also the vulnerability of the political events. I suppose astute leadership at the national level is something that need to be focused on. Good governance as a term is something that Pacific Island countries look at suspiciously. Whenever it's mentioned, the immediate meaning comes in, we have bad governments. And yet governance and governments are probably a function of each other, but not exactly the same thing. And I think really we need to do it in such a way that we make friends and not put people on the defensive. Because a lot of times, well-meaning international or regional assistance programs actually generate the opposite and equal reaction on the other end, one of defense. One of the critical issues in the Pacific that came up is land. And if you like, maybe up to 80% of all the problems that many Pacific Island countries at the moment experience is due to land. There hasn't been very good work done on land tenure and land ownership systems. How do you unlock the economic potential of land in whatever is little land available, and at the same time safeguard what is sacred to many of the resource owners, ownership rights to these people? So I think what we're looking at there is a balance between unlocking the economic potential and yet safeguarding that ownership so that people don't get threatened. I think it's very important to address land issues. Yes, labour is very important. Land issues, I think if we don't have a solution to land issues in the Pacific, we will continue to talk about symptoms. Thank you.
Dr. Jimmy Rogers. The next session concentrated on Papua New Guinea, and the main speaker was Ted Wolfers, a professor of history and politics and an advisor to the PNG government. Ted Wolfers took up the theme of context with a personal anecdote.
So let me explain where I'm coming from.
I live in an area where the main bridge linking us to town has been cut for a few years and has only recently been rebuilt. Our local police station has been closed. The range of services provided at the closest hospital have been severely reduced. As I'm frequently called away from home for long periods, it's been burgled four or five times in the last few years. It's hard to be sure because sometimes one group takes advantage of what the others have done. My friends don't go to meetings of the local political party that's dominant in the area because they can't stand the violence at the meetings. A former long-serving head of the local government in the area was killed a few years ago in what the local media have described as a ritual murder. Unemployment and underemployment are high by national standards. Previous mining activity has caused ongoing environmental problems. And when I was driving my family home from the airport a few months ago, our car was stopped at two police roadblocks erected following and to prevent any increase in inter-ethnic tensions in communities close to the main road. The situation I've described is not unique, but the home I describe is not in some exotic place overseas. It's on the south coast of New South Wales. Interesting, even exciting, as isolated facts and incidents might sometimes be, context and perspective matter. Or let me quote from a paper which deals with Australia's relations with the South Pacific, especially Melanesia. Prepared by an influential national body, it draws attention to a number of worrying possibilities in Papua New Guinea. These include the possible arrival of foreigners of uncertain motivation and the absence or inadequacy of existing laws and arrangements for regulating their activities and the fear that criminals might come there. Related documents refer to the likelihood that the area might be used for illegal trafficking in drugs, alcohol and tobacco-like substances. Another contemporary concern is with the illegal movement of people looking or recruited for work in Australia. If these concerns sound familiar, they are. They can certainly be found in the Australian Senate Committee report on relations with the South Pacific, but the documents I've just quoted were written in 1883. As in so many other aspects of
warming to his theme, Professor Wolfers argued that despite the popular analysis of Papua New Guinea as a developing nation in decline, there was another quite different way of looking at it.
In March, a body of experts, not representatives of member states or of UN specialised or other international organisations, recommended that Papua New Guinea be reclassified from a developing to one of the world's 50 least developed countries. The criteria for inclusion in the list are somewhat technical. They include GNP per capita and ratings on indices which purport to measure human assets and economic vulnerability. At the same time, a number of other Pacific Island countries have been evaluated as eligible for graduation. The three that I'm aware of are Kiribati, Tuvalu and Vanuatu. The symbolism of the occasion is reinforced, at least for the historically minded, by the simultaneous recommendation that Zimbabwe should also be relegated to the list of least developed countries. And there were certainly quite a few Australians in the late colonial period who thought that Zimbabwe, which was then southern Rhodesia, was really a very appropriate model for the political future of Papua New Guinea. It's further reinforced by the fact that Papua New Guinea will now join on the list another country which in the colonial period was held up as a model which Australian colonial policy should emulate, which is Democratic Congo. I'm not being facetious when I make these points. It just is useful to remember, to get in historical context, what has happened in Papua New Guinea. I also want to make the point that I think that the international indicators that are increasingly used to discuss these issues are not ways of thinking about developing countries, they're ways of not thinking about them. They're ways of dealing with, you know, more than 100 countries when you're sitting in New York or London or Washington or wherever it is and going down a list. They're not necessarily particularly useful if you're actually trying to understand events. It also assumes that development is some kind of a horse race, that it's the rankings that matter rather than the domestic achievements relative to where you're starting from. What we can say is that on some indicators, Papua New Guinea has done remarkably well. That, for example, in the period since independence, life expectancy has gone up by quite a few years from what it was at independence. And this is where I would argue that one of the things that's happening in Papua New Guinea is that at least on some measures, the country has paid or is paying the price of its own success. That, for example, population is rising, presumably, there's no other explanation I can see, because public health services have actually worked and have done something to improve public health. It does suggest that we now have a huge problem, that simply to keep things going at the levels they were at, you've got to generate far more money than ever before. The problem in Papua New Guinea is not, for example, to deal with poverty. It is to deal with an active process of impoverishment, which is a very different thing. It arises because of rising population, growing stress on environment, and above all else, probably, changes in behaviour and changes in taste. People want more than they had because they're aware of things that they didn't have before and very often see themselves as relatively disadvantaged. They don't or don't want to develop gardening skills even where they can be used. And one can see this, for example, in the growing volume of basic food that goes to villages from town. It's not a universal...
The speaker is Professor Ted Wolfers, who's worked between PNG and Australia for many years. He believes the level of political sophistication in Papua New Guinea is commonly underestimated.
The problem very frequently is not that Papua New Guineans don't understand what they should be doing, but that they do. They do understand how the political system works. They do understand how to vote. They just use it in ways that tell you a great deal more about social change in Melanesia than the lectures delivered by international experts. When Papua New Guinea had a preferential voting system, in most electorates, it delivered a first-past-the-post result, and where it didn't, there were threats of violence because people said they couldn't understand. Now, when Papua New Guinea introduced a first-past-the-post system, which recognised those realities, if you like, and was in most countries seen as a way of reducing the number of competing parties and candidates, exactly the reverse happened, because people understood at the local level how to use the system, not because they failed to. It doesn't make them right, but it does mean that we are dealing with a much more complex situation than is often understood. And the people...
Ted Wolfers offered an example of how a lack of understanding of PNG society could have significant and counterproductive effects.
All over Papua New Guinea, there are large signs telling you that you should use a condom. In a society where many people have been brought up by churches that preach against it and do preach faithfulness in marriage, the signs don't say, in many cases, be faithful. They start off with a picture of a condom. When you check into a hotel now, there is very frequently a condom on the end of the bed or a condom vending machine in the vestibule. I may be very insensitive, but it doesn't send me quite the signal that I think those who come in from outside to advise on these things intend. And my experience with the people I know is that they react in very similar ways, that we need to be very careful about the context in which we're operating. And we need to be very careful, for example, about a widespread belief, which has been documented in the media recently, that actually AIDS is a European plot to get people in other parts of the world. That might sound very strange here. I know people who believe that. It may make it very important to find different strategies for dealing with an issue like that.
The forum heard a worst-case scenario for Papua New Guinea, based on the experiences in African countries, that HIV/AIDS could knock out almost a third of the nation's workforce by the year 2020. Ted Wolfers concluded by expressing regret that Australian universities had lost interest in Papua New Guinea and that the broader public view is of a deeply troubled, unstable society. He was encouraged, though, by the recent engagement he's observed in Bougainville.
I'm a bit more optimistic about the future now because I think quite a large number of young Australians and New Zealanders, together with Fijians and Ni Vanuatu, served as truce and peace monitors in Bougainville. They seem to me to be remarkably fine ambassadors for the countries from which they came. In a very difficult situation, as far as I'm aware, there were no untoward incidents at all, unlike the situation with similar operations in other parts of the world. They have the advantage over other people that they don't just see Papua New Guinea as a problem or a set of problems, but as a nation of people struggling with varying degrees of skill and success to make their way in a rapidly changing world. And what's interesting is the numbers who are now coming back for various jobs. Perhaps that's why the outgoing Papua New Guinea Foreign Minister, Sarabi Namuliu, has placed so much emphasis on people-to-people relations. It might be that this provides something of a basis then for addressing a restructuring of the relationships, that there is now at least a sizeable cadre of people who do have some understanding of the societies with which they're dealing and are perhaps more likely, therefore, to be able to work out long-term Australian relationships with them.
Professor Ted Wolfers from the University of Wollongong and an advisor to the government of Papua New Guinea. And this is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National.
Thank you, Ted.
PNG's High Commissioner to Australia was at the forum and he offered some comment on the political relationship between Canberra and Port Moresby and attempts to rebuild people-to-people links. High Commissioner Charles Lepani.
At the political level, the utterances that you get from Australia and Papua New Guinea, it reminds me of a recent statement by a Member of Parliament, probably in Canberra, that you should revert back to paternalism to deal with your Aboriginal problems. There is a problem at that level, and that's why Minister of Foreign Affairs then, Sir Rabin Amalu, is beginning to seriously look at people-to-people contact. And my work in Canberra is not so much dealing with AUSAID or Foreign Affairs. I think they rarely see me in their offices. I'm more out in the bush at the local government council levels, at the Rotarians. Just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was in Orange, standing next to a garbage truck that they were going to donate to Mount Hagen. And that, to me, is more important in the end, to try and rebuild that friendship, the substantive friendship that used to exist between Papua New Guinea and Australia, and the understanding that flowed. I don't agree with regular utterances of commentators that since independence, as if on September date of independence to now, there is this curve on the decline. It wasn't. It was a stable curve. In fact, it was an increasing curve of good management, good governance 10 or 15 years after independence. Then there is the realization by politicians that they need to control the public purse in order to please their constituencies. The slush fund concept came into being. Governance issues began to emerge. So it is, as Sir John Crawford, one of the greatest friends of Papua New Guinea, if he was alive today, I'm sure he would cringe at the public policy approach of Australia to Papua New Guinea. He said to us once in his one of his many regular visitations to Papua New Guinea at independence, shortly after independence, that, you know, I fear you've set yourself such a high standard that soon you will just go down. His prediction was right, but in a manner that has a sense of responsibility as to how we should be looking forward, not in a euphoria of independence, political independence, but of the future of Papua New Guinea and where we should be heading in the country. And there are still a lot of good Papua New Guineans thinking about this issue, trying to redefine the context of Papua New Guinea and deal with it in a manner that Australians may not agree with and international agencies may not agree with. There are problems. We've got the AIDS problem. You've got the forestry issues, gang rape of our women in Papua New Guinea. These are serious problems. We can't neglect those. A lot of Papua New Guineans are concerned about them. A lot of Papua New Guineans are quietly going about their way trying to resolve these issues or deal with these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles.
Charles Lepani, Papua New Guinea's High Commissioner in Australia. Discussion of the Solomon Islands was next and naturally focused on the regional assistance mission known as RAMSI. RAMSI is dominated by Australia. The Australian government contributes about $200 million a year and most RAMSI personnel are Australian. But it is a Pacific Islands initiative, as described earlier by Greg Irwin. After 3 years, RAMSI's initial law and order focus has shifted to governance and development, although the April riots and arson were a setback, destroying a large part of Honiara's commercial centre and doing some damage to RAMSI's credibility. Clive Moore was next to speak. He's head of history at the University of Queensland and a Melanesia specialist.
RAMSI really has about four phases, I think you'd say. Phase one, which was to restore law and order, and they did that very successfully, and I think the people of the Solomons are very happy that that occurred. Phase two is to restore regularity to the public service. A large number of the police, about a quarter of the force, were removed because of their connections with the militants. About 400 officers were actually removed as well. There were line positions put in from public servants from outside into Treasury, Finance and Health, and it certainly restored regularity to the public service. Public servants had no idea if they're going to be paid this month or the next month before that occurred. Phase three is really to look at long-term development and strengthen early infrastructure reforms. And phase four is a withdrawal, which probably people seem to talk about a 10-year time period. When Ramsay went in, they had a fairly compliant government that had invited them in, and that was the government of Sir Alan Kemakeza. And in many ways, it was Ramsay that set the agenda, not the government of the Solomon Islands. They were desperately pleased to see anybody come in to try and sort out particularly the violence that was occurring. What is occurring in the Solomons now, though, is a new government, the government of Manasseh Sogavare, who has a different agenda and a different emphasis on sovereignty and restoring sovereignty than the previous government when Ramsay first went in there. It seems to me that Sogavare wants to redefine Ramsay's priorities, certainly in phases two and three, and maybe also in phase four. Ramsay never really wanted to become directly involved in rural development and land reforms, and it's concentrated more on law and order and justice and on finance. It seems to me that Ramsay must be seeing there's a certain diminishing rate of returns in their efforts to do with law and order and justice, and they really should be thinking about whether they are doing the right thing in the emphasis for the future of the Solomons. Not all Solomon Islanders think Ramsay addresses their needs and realities. I think it is time, and I suspect Sogavare government will say the same thing, that there has to be a change in emphasis away from law and order towards development. Ramsay's performed fairly poorly when it comes to social and cultural interaction with Solomon Islands. Ramsay didn't handle the April riots well at all. There are serious problems about the relationship between the Ramsay police, the participating police force, and the Royal Solomon Islands police. There seem to be very poor intelligence sources getting to Ramsay, and certainly there's a problem, I said, between information being passed from one police force to the other. And Ramsay seems to have problems reading Solomon Islanders and reading what the political processes are going to be.
Clive Moore provided a broad critique of Ramsay's work and the challenges it faces. And he picked up on concerns from within Solomon Islands government circles about the insertion of Ramsay people into critical public service positions, known as in-line positions. This has raised questions of sovereignty.
Ramsay is criticised for the maintenance of line positions in the public service, and I also would raise a question about whether after 3 years so many of them are necessary and what level of localisation and training for localisation has occurred. Public prosecutor has just been localised very recently. But there are many others, I think, where Solomon Islanders are wondering about the foreigners in their public service and exactly what's happening. The Westminster system has been discussed here. It quite clearly never really failed in the Solomon Islands because it never really was their organic institution. And that's one of the problems that we're discussing today and that Australia also has to come to terms with when it comes to the Westminster system and also the public service system, how it works. I've, in talking to various of the Ramsay officials, often argued with them about they want the public service largely to follow an Australian public service model. And when it comes to the one-talk system and customary ways of behaving and the way that the Solomon's public service works and the way that the Parliament interacts with it, certainly not like ours. So that there are problems, I think, with Australian cultural ways and implementation of what it would like to see happening there. I would say that The first thing to understanding the Solomons is to understand the village. 87% of Solomon Islanders still live in a rural environment. They might be involved in cash cropping as well, but basically the government structure doesn't affect them a great deal. So the key is rural development. The second thing is that reconciliation has never really been achieved between the militant groups. There has to be some sort of cultural understanding reached between those two groups, and I don't think it's there yet. The third thing is civil society, and that it's very important in the working of Pacific nations. It's a way of involving women in grassroots and all sorts of levels of decision-making. They're sadly absent from the Solomon Islands Parliament. The Solomons has managed to have two women in Parliament since the 1960s, and only one in the post-independent House. And the fourth thing I'd say that it's time to rethink the role of the central and provincial governments and their relationship with the ordinary citizens and their land. And again, these are themes which have come up before. The new Sogavare government has signalled various things. It's signalled that it will take its own sovereignty, I think, much more seriously than the Kimakaza government did. My reading of the Sogavare government is that it satisfies the various regional areas. It's in various ways that are complicated to explain. The west of the Solomons is with Sogavare. Guadalcanal and Malaita have also... he's made very good moves over a number of years to get them on his side. And I think Ramsay must listen to him and try as much as possible to support the Sogavare government in their endeavours, particularly when it comes to rural development and land reform. That's probably quite enough from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Associate Professor Clive Moore from the University of Queensland.
Sherry Louise O'Callaghan.
One of those to comment on Clive Moore's assessment was Mary Louise O'Callaghan, a journalist who lives in the Solomon Islands and has reported from there for the past 16 years. She has also given public affairs advice to the Ramsay leadership. Mary Louise O'Callaghan challenged the criticism of inline public service positions.
The reality is there are five inline people in finance only, which is one of the key areas they complain about. The head of finance is the senior Solomon Island public servant who was in that position when Ramsay arrived. And the special coordinator and, I would believe, funders back in Canberra are quite relaxed at the idea of senior Solomon Islanders coming back into senior positions if they are willing and if they are able. And in the case, for instance, of the position of the Accountant General, a gutsy Australian official, one of the inline positions. She's constantly being told by ministers that they send the guys to her so she can say no instead of them to the sort of funding requests and accounts that they like to submit. And I think one of the strengths of Ramsay has been that it's taken a long-term approach. I was quite shocked as a sort of constant critic of Australia's policy in the region when Ramsay was designed that it actually did look at issues beyond security and was willing to take on some really tough ones. Now, none of those ones, because they are tough and because they have come out of many years of practices in the Solomon Islands that predate the ethnic tensions, are going to be resolved overnight. And one of those is the difficulty of Solomon Island officials to enforce regulations, even when they would like to, because of the sort of pressures on them and their often their difficulty within their own culture to say no to people. And you find people are often grateful in private for the buffer those very few inline positions create. The other inline, I guess you'd call it, position that is of concern to the government, and I would be less able to defend it, I think, is the position of an Australian Federal Police officer in the as police commissioner. It's actually made Ramsay much more vulnerable, and Australia probably much more vulnerable to accusations of politicising policing, as we saw after the riots when Charles Dalsabaya and Nelson Ney, two MPs, were arrested and charged with incitement. Now, there appears to be evidence coming before the courts that quite justify those charges, but when you've got an Australian Federal Policeman as the police commissioner of the local police, it's much easier for those accusations to be made and to be used as an excuse also.
Mary Louise O'Callaghan. This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, and you're listening to an edited version of a forum on Australia's role in the South Pacific. The final speaker is Imrana Jalal on future directions. Imrana Jalal is a human rights lawyer from Fiji, widely known for her civil society activism. She began with a Pacific Islander's view of Australia.
From our side, I think it's fair to say that the Pacific Islander attitude towards Australia tends to be grateful yet suspicious. For the most significant player in our region, strategically, politically, economically and socially, you're not terribly well informed about us for our liking. For historical and other reasons, and dare I say some of them cultural, Australia still does not appear to have much of an instinct for the Pacific. In contrast, the New Zealanders have always appeared to be more comfortable with the region and their role in it, and are consistently better at engaging with us. There are sound historical reasons for this, of course, including New Zealand's greater and longer acknowledgement of their own Indigenous population and their old, close and growing association with Polynesia. Consequently, many of us feel that terms such as the arc of instability and failing states that are bandied around about us simply underscore the superficiality of the assessments of Pacific Island states and a readiness to apply questionable assumptions across what is in fact one of the most geographically, economically and culturally complex regions in the world.
There is an assumption. The region's cultural complexity is guaranteed by its sheer diversity, and community loyalties make nationhood difficult. Imrana Jalal again.
In several countries such as Papua New Guinea, Solomons and Vanuatu, nationhood is a real challenge. The attachment respective communities have for their specific areas and linguistic affiliation in Melanesia is not too readily understood or appreciated elsewhere. In Fiji, Indigenous Fijian loyalties to their provinces, their tikinas and their matangalis, most often placed above national interests, are poorly understood also. The political crises of May 2000 and the siege of Parliament showed clearly these affiliations as being paramount, that identity matters more than the rule of law or democracy to most. Voting patterns in Fiji's 2006 general election, which saw 81% of both major races, Indigenous Fijian and Indian Fijian, voting on unequivocal racial lines, irrespective of issues or platforms which purported to offer better health or education policies, further demonstrate affiliations to identity rather than nation. These factors pose real difficulties for the development of state institutions and for the building of democratic institutions. The challenge for us in the Pacific is to build a democracy that is relevant to our needs and our culture. Democracy is a foreign flower, we are told by many of our leaders. It does not fit into our culture. It is against chiefly leadership. It does not recognise the special rights of Indigenous people. Democracy, I would argue, can exist side by side with a chiefly system if that is what the people want. And that should be accepted whether it is palatable or not to our outside supporters. A democracy does not require the dissolution of chiefly leadership, but it does require traditional leadership to be accountable. This is not based on logic, but on identity. But it must change and evolve to maintain its relevance to the emerging modern Pacific. And we Pacific Islanders ourselves need to make that happen.
Human rights lawyer Imrana Jalal. On the matter of security, she argued Australia's national security interests differ from Pacific interests.
The fourth pillar of the Pacific Plan is improved security for the region. It specifically outlines at Strategic Objective 13, improved political and social conditions for stability and safety. Those who criticise this element of the plan suggest that the overarching emphasis appears to be a disproportionate concern about national security, particularly Australian national security. Since Pacific Island countries are not yet to be overly concerned with external threats, there is an argument that security in this context ought to be more about human security within our borders rather than focused only on national security. True security for Pacific Islanders is human security, which encompasses economic, food, health, environmental, personal and community security, environmental security, which recognises environmental threats to our region and the threat of internal armed conflict, and economic security, which is about access to resources, finances and markets necessary to sustain acceptable levels of welfare and state power. The promotion of human security is necessary to prevent violent conflict from erupting within our borders, within our region. And human security is tied up with human rights, effective governance and the rule of law.
Environment security was identified by Imrana Jalal as an area where the clash of regional interests is clear.
Pacific Islanders are intimately connected to the land and the sea. This connection is described in the Fijian notion of the vanua. Your position on the Kyoto Protocol was, with respect, a failure of leadership, notwithstanding your admirable position during the International Whaling Commission. What appeared to be paramount was the protection of private enterprise rather than any attempt to have a dialogue about the challenges. There's little doubt that the present rate of hydrocarbon emissions produced by Australian industry is a significant factor in present levels of prosperity. The long-term prognosis for us is not good and has serious implications not only for the global community but for several low-lying Pacific Island nations in particular. It required leadership from Australia as a middle-ranking power that regularly punches above its weight. Instead, Australia has set itself resolutely against any compromises and has allied itself with the United States. The non-involvement of newly emerging powerhouses such as China and India are cited as reasons for their continuing refusal to be part of any compromise. Because of the direct implications of your policies on us and the islands, we are entitled to question the level of Australia's commitment to our region on an issue such as this. We ask that in your policies you consider that the Pacific environment needs greater consideration from you.
Imrana Jalal concluded with some examples of civil society's successes in the Pacific, including major political victories in Fiji.
As many of you will know, in the year 2001, it was the NGOs who mounted the Chandrika Prasad constitutional challenge in court, and it was they who harnessed their resources. They got Geoffrey Robertson in to argue the case for them, and that was a totally civil society-driven initiative. And so really it was the civil society organisations in Fiji that brought constitutional rule back to Fiji. You would have heard during the last year about the famous Ratu Bill, the Reconciliation, Tolerance and Unity Bill, whose main political objective was to forgive those who had created the coups in Fiji. There was a massive NGO and civil society mobilisation effort last year. They made submissions to the Great Council of Chiefs. They used the media very effectively. And as you know, that bill has currently been shelved, at least for now. Some of the other things that are happening, a group of civil society organisations prevented the dumping of toxic waste by a Taiwanese company in Makira province in the Solomon Islands. In Tuvalu, using the language of human rights, a group of NGOs managed to stop the Tuvalu government from interfering with the state coverage of the elections in Tuvalu. Also in Tuvalu, a group of NGOs have managed to get the government to adopt a policy to prevent exposing the privacy of individuals living with HIV/AIDS in Tuvalu. So there are lots of wonderful community government activities that are occurring all over the Pacific. In conclusion, we in the Pacific are good people and we need your help to give our people a fighting chance to share in the benefits of development. Australia has a significant role to play as the largest and wealthiest country in the neighbourhood. It has to engage the Pacific on terms that enable it to contribute meaningfully and effectively to the development of our islands as viable and stable members of the global community. Thank you, Tomas.
That was an edited version of a seminar on Australia's role in the South Pacific, hosted by the Australian Institute of International Affairs. You can find a link to the AIIA on the Background Briefing website, and that's where you can also listen to this program again or download it as a podcast. I'm Chris Bullock, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.